It is Friday, November 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a judge orders the White House to return a press pass to a CNN reporter. With the U.S. midterm elections over, both parties look towards 2020. And the Country Music Association Awards honor a number of performers. It's all ahead. The White House has been ordered to return CNN correspondent Jim Acosta's press credentials, which it had suspended after a contentious exchange the journalist had with President Donald Trump during an East Room news conference. Following the ruling, Acosta spoke to the news media in Washington.
Everybody, thanks for coming. I just want to say something very briefly, and that is I want to thank all of my colleagues in the press who supported us this week. And I want to thank the judge for the decision he made today. And let's go back to work.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman tells me the reasons the judge gave for the ruling.
Well, the judge was essentially saying that the network and Acosta were not given due process. He stressed that there was a highly unusual set of facts with this case, but that he was ruling only on the Fifth Amendment due process aspect of the case, and not the overall First Amendment issue.
Now, this judge, Timothy Kelly, was appointed by President Trump.
Yes, he's considered quite a conservative judge, but he obviously thought that at least concerning the due process aspect that the government's case was relatively weak. He said the reason he was issuing the temporary restraining order that had been requested from the network is that they were likely to prevail in demonstrating that the correspondent was denied a due process in the credential revocation process. Essentially, the reporter showed back up at the White House one evening and was told by the Secret Service to hand over what's called the hard pass, which is the sort of permanent pass to get into the White House. And the network and the judge agreed that there should have been some sort of process before this was just arbitrarily taken away from him.
Well, one of the interesting things about this case that Fox News, which is seen, is it's viewed as very supportive of President Trump, that backed CNN's legal effort.
Yes, and all more than a dozen news organizations have filed Friends of the Court briefs supporting CNN's legal effort. And what they're realizing is if there is a precedent, this could go badly for them in a future administration where, say, it's a president who doesn't like them in office.
I remember during the days of Watergate, the press was often contentious with then-President Richard Nixon. But I don't recall any other president just suddenly withdrawing a White House correspondent's press pass like that.
Yeah, this does seem quite unprecedented, but we should state for the record that presidents going back at least to Franklin Roosevelt have had serious differences with reporters and admonished them. Richard Nixon also was known as having quite a hostile relationship with the media. In fact, he kept an enemies list of some journalists he did not like. But for the White House to pull the credentials of a particular reporter after a testy exchange during a news conference is really something extraordinary.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Thousands of people are still unable to return to the site of the deadliest wildfire in California history. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May sticks to her Brexit position as a rebellion against her grows. Khmer Rouge leaders are found guilty of genocide. And WikiLeaks says its leader, Julian Assange, will be charged by the United States. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers led by scientists from the Natural History Museum of Denmark and the University of Copenhagen have verified their 2015 discovery of a meteorite impact crater buried beneath the Greenland ice sheet. The crater was found about 1 kilometer under the ice of the Hiawatha Glacier in northwestern Greenland. Researchers describe it as being 31 kilometers in diameter and say it is among the 25 largest impact craters on Earth. The researchers studied a topographical map of the ground beneath the Greenland ice sheet in July 2015. They found a huge depression under the Hiawatha Glacier that hadn't been seen before. They followed up their analysis with airplanes equipped with powerful radar that flew over the crater and then visited the site itself to map and gather further evidence that confirmed the discovery. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we remember the 40th anniversary of the Jonestown Massacre. Even as vote counting continues in a handful of races from this year's midterm U.S. elections, both major political parties are already focused on the next challenge, the 2020 presidential contest. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
It was a big day yesterday.
At his post-election news conference, President Donald Trump tried to put a positive spin on election results that left Democrats in control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 8 years.
I am Congresswoman-elect Rashida.
This was a great victory for us. And again, from a deal-making standpoint, we are all much better off the way it turned out. Because I really believe if the Democrats want to, we can do a tremendous amount of great legislation.
With Trump's help, Republicans added slightly to their majority in the Senate. But Democrats are already pointing to this year's election returns as a warning sign for the president as he prepares for his re-election bid in 2020. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
Republicans lost women, minorities, and suburban voters across the country that by such margins that should worry every Republican candidate in 2020 and President Trump.
Trump was a key factor in this year's midterms for voters in both parties, says analyst John Fortier.
Donald Trump did very well in red states and in rural places and smaller cities, but Democrats really built their victories on the waves of the suburbs, where more educated white voters came out strongly against him.
The challenge for Democrats now is to find a balance between working with the president and investigating his administration, says Larry Sabato.
They've got a comfortable buffer, but it's nothing like the Republican sweep of 2010. And if Democrats don't remember that, they're going to be in power for 2 years in the House, and then Trump will get reelected and bring the Republicans back in.
Democrats won some key governor's races in the upper Midwest this month, and that could help them in the 2020 presidential race, says Jim Kessler.
Democrats broke through in the states where Trump had broken through in 2016. In Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, Democrats nominated moderates for governor. They all won in those states. So the wall, the blue wall that crumbled in 2016 is being rebuilt again if Democrats nominate the right person in 2020.
In January, Democrats will alter the balance of power in Washington by taking over the House. At the same time, Democrats are also looking ahead to 2020 and the process of choosing a presidential nominee who will try to deny President Trump a second 4-year term. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Sunday marks the 40th anniversary of the massacre of hundreds of cult followers of the San Francisco-based People's Temple of the Reverend Jim Jones in a remote utopian enclave in the former South American British colony of Guyana. Among the dead, U.S. Congressman Leo Ryan, who went to investigate what was happening to loved ones of many of his worried constituents. Congressional aide, now Congresswoman Jackie Speier, accompanied Ryan and was wounded. She is adamant today that what happened was not a mass suicide, but mass murder. Jones demanded more than 900 followers, including children, drink a powdered drink mix laced with cyanide. Julia Shears is a journalist and author who wrote the book A Thousand Lives about Jonestown in 2011. She tells International Edition's Victor Beatty this was a horrific case of mass murder.
Jim Jones wanted the world to believe that people willingly lined up and drank this poison punch, but it's a mythology. They were killed. So Jackie Speier and I are on the same page as far as that is concerned.
We're talking about 914 adults and children. How did this come about?
Think of 1978, Guyana, middle of the jungle. They were completely cut off from the outside world. Jim Jones led them to believe that if they did not like this utopian society that they were going to create, that they could come back to California. However, when they got to Jonestown, which was a two-day river journey, he took away their passports, he took away their money, and he told them that if they wanted to go home, they could swim home. From there, things just got worse. There was only one ham radio for communication with the outside, and no one was allowed to use it except for Jim Jones and his inner circle. All of the mail coming into and out of the compound was censored. There was no way, once he had them trapped down there, for the people of Jonestown to let the world know what was really happening.
How could people on such a mass scale be mesmerized by one man?
Like anyone who goes to church, I grew up in the church. And when you belong to a church, it's about so much more than the minister. It's about the sense of a common goal. In People's Temple's case, you know, they had some very noble beliefs. They believed in trying to create a better society where there would be no sexism or racism or elitism. That's what Jonestown was supposed to be, this model utopian society. So they get down there hoping to participate in this bold social experiment, and then they found out that Jim Jones suddenly is talking about this idea of his called revolutionary suicide. And it's in Jonestown for the first time where he starts to take votes on who is willing to die for socialism. He didn't talk about that back in the United States. He only raised that prospect of quote-unquote revolutionary suicide when he had them all trapped in Jonestown.
Couldn't they have seen trouble coming? Did any of them break away before they made the move to Guyana?
Some people left the church before the move to Guyana, but it was really hard to extricate yourself because they lived in communes. They had to forfeit all of their money to the church. If they left, they would be cut off from their loved ones who were still in the organization. He made it very difficult for people to leave.
Author Julia Shears. She doesn't think such a massacre could occur today, finding it difficult to imagine in an era of cell phones, satellite phones, and social media that so many people could be cut off from the outside world. And Shears believes, for better or worse, people today are more skeptical and cynical, as opposed to a time when many sought alternative lifestyles and were more trusting. Her simple takeaway, trust your conscience if you see or hear things that don't seem right. Fiji Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama is leading the count in national elections held in the South Pacific nation Wednesday. The poll is being contested by two former military officers who have previously staged coups in Fiji. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Frank Bainimarama has held power in Fiji since 2006, when he led a military uprising against an elected government. He said he seized power in an attempt to combat institutional racism and corruption, but he was labelled in some quarters as a dictator. International sanctions followed the 2006 bloodless coup, and Fijians would have to wait 8 years for democracy to be restored. In 2014, Bainimarama resigned from the military and became prime minister in a landslide election victory. Results posted on the government's social media account show Bainimarama's Fiji First Party with a comfortable lead so far, as counting in the South Pacific archipelago continues. Voting in some areas has been delayed by bad weather. The incumbent Prime Minister's main rival in the 2018 election is a former army officer, Sitiveni Rambuka, who led two military coups in 1987. The instability was caused by fears that Fiji's government would be dominated by the ethnic Indian minority. Indo-Fijians make up about one-third of the population. They were brought to the islands in the 19th and 20th centuries to work on Britain's colonial sugarcane plantations. Professor John Frankel is an analyst from the University of Victoria in Wellington, New Zealand.
Of course, we have a very strange contest because now, unlike 2014, we're pitting two coup leaders against each other. The 1987 coup leader, Sitiveni Rambuka, has made a startling comeback to head the main opposition party, and he's fighting against Frank Bainimarama, also a former military commander who staged the 2006 coup. It's definitely a competitive election campaign. Of course, given Fiji's history, there are always fears that if the result goes the wrong way, the military might step in.
Australia has been a keen supporter of democracy in Fiji. In 2014, it lifted sanctions imposed after the 2006 coup. Canberra has been eager to re-engage with Fiji to counter China's rising influence in the South Pacific. Post-coup Fiji has been welcomed back into the international community, with Britain's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan visiting in October. Fiji has a population of about 900,000 people. The tropical islands lie two-thirds of the way from Hawaii to New Zealand. Over 500,000 Fijians were eligible to vote in this year's election. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
One of the biggest nights in country music happened this week, the 52nd Annual Country Music Association Awards, otherwise known as the CMAs. Nikki Strong is here to tell us who won what and more. So, Nikki, tell us some of the highlights.
Well, I will say Carrie Underwood was a highlight in and of herself. Not only has she been, this is like her 11th year hosting, and her and Brad Paisley do a great job. She did a gender reveal. She's pregnant, and she revealed that she's having a boy. She also did a great performance of her song, Love Wins. And I think she underwent 11 dress changes. And she's huge.
Oh.
She's huge. So it was really, and she looked precious. Like, it was beautiful to see. But I was like, wow, that's a lot of work. I mean, she's huge. So I think she was great. I think she was a highlight. And she won Best Female Vocalist of the Year, which I also think is great because her last album has not received a lot of support in terms of the industry, but it's like been breaking certain records. Like, her sales, they just skyrocketed in ways they weren't anticipating. The fact that she won this award. So it just seems like she keeps winning in spite of. And so we love that. Ricky Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder. Hands down, best performance of the night, in my opinion. Ricky Skaggs is a big bluegrass country artist. He was recently inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. And he, along with Marty Stewart, they were joined by Brad Paisley and Keith Urban. But it really was just like a traditional, like, homegrown country jam session. They had Sierra Hall on mandolin, Justin Moses on banjo, Carson Peters on fiddles. It was musicianship at the highest level. So no big lighting, no big dancers. It was, they brought everybody to their feet with just singing and playing. So it was amazing. Another performance that rocked the house was Chris Stapleton. So he was joined by Mavis Staples, Maren Morris, and his wife Morgan for the song Friendship, which was actually originally done by Mavis Staples' father, Pop Staples. And then they segued into I'll Take You There. So it involved some incredible singing and just brought everyone to their feet. So that was great. Garth Brooks debuted a song that no one had heard. And so he did a song reveal. Carrie did the gender reveal. He did a song reveal. So no one had heard this song. Maybe like 10 people, if that much. And it's a song that he dedicated to his wife, and it was about his wife. She had not heard the song. So they had like a spotlight on her in the audience, and they had a spotlight on him. It was a very emotional, heartfelt song. He was fighting back tears as he was singing it. It was called Stronger Than Me. And so there was a lot of wet eyes in the audience in that moment. Let me see the other moments too, but I'm gonna talk about Kacey Musgraves. Kacey Musgraves not only did a really nice performance, a really great performance of her song Slow Burn, but she won for Best Album of the Year. Now this was major because she was the only woman in the category. And so she beat them out. And then also, she's a songwriter. So it was a winner for songwriters, a winner for the underdog, a win for women. She also is an artist that hasn't gotten a lot of radio commercial play, despite her album getting critical acclaim. And so she was really the long shot in winning. And the fact that she won was amazing. And 10 years to the day, it was the day that she moved to Nashville.
Oh.
Yeah, so that was kind of like synchronistic. So that was nice.
Who else won what?
Let me see. Vocal duo Brothers Osborne. They won for a third time in the row. Dan and Shay were favored to win that one. So that was like, whoa. But Brothers Osborne, they're great. So is Dan and Shay. New Artist of the Year was Luke Combs. Well-deserved. Vocal group was Old Dominion. They beat out Little Big Town's winning streak. So that was a surprise there. Music video was Thomas Rhett's Marry Me. Musical event of the year was Everything's Gonna Be All Right, David Lee Murphy with Kenny Chesney. Musician of the year was McNally for guitar. Entertainer of the year, Keith Urban. This was the first time in 13 years that he actually won in this category.
Wow.
So he was fighting back tears, too. He really was not expecting it. So congratulations to him. That was major. And Chris Stapleton was the favored one of the night. I think he becomes the default person to win. He walked away with 3 trophies. He won Male Vocalist of the Year. No surprise. Someone's going to have to outsing him in order to win it, beat him in that category. And he won for Best Single and Best Song of the Year for Broken Halos.
You can hear music from all of the winners and nominees of the CMAs on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook and Twitter at VOA1 The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Sing my share of broken halos, folding wings that used to fly. They've all gone wherever they go, broken halos that used to
The music of Chris Stapleton brings an end to our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on the Voice of America.